It's Friday. All that work and it's ended. Well, anyway, thank you so much for coming. I have a wonderful time doing this, and I hope that you enjoy hearing some of what I think are fantastic facts about how the world works. Today I want to talk about Johannes Kepler. He is clearly one of the great geniuses of science in our time, and an amazing person. He was a deeply religious human being. He was born on the 27th of December in 1571. He was born at 2:30 p.m., and he was conceived on the 16th of May, 1571, at 4:37 a.m. Now, these dates and times are very important, as he used them to cast his own horoscopes. And as I mentioned, I think yesterday, the time, the interval between conception and birth was 7.5 months, so he was clearly a premature child. And of course, not being sentient at the time of his conception, he used his parents' wedding date. Where he got 4:37 a.m. is clearly beyond. I don't bother with, you know. He was a weak and sickly, but very clearly intelligent young boy. He was just an infant during the famous new star, the supernova of 1572 that so affected Tycho Brahe. But he saw and was deeply impressed by the comet of 1577 when he was 6 years old. He was a Protestant, but of a somewhat heretical bent, that is more Calvinist than was acceptable in the Lutheran situation in which he grew up, to say nothing of the Catholic regions not far away. As a young man, he went to the University of Tübingen, where he was prepared to study theology. But while he was there, the university senate recommended him for a scholarship, and they noted that, and I'll quote, "He had such a superior and magnificent mind that something special may be expected of him." Those are very pregnant words. At Tübingen, although he did study theology, he came under the influence of Professor Michael Mestlin. And Mestlin persuaded him to study mathematics and astronomy, which in those days were almost the same subject. History, of course, is incredibly grateful to Mestlin for that intervention. During his third year, and perhaps under Mestlin's influence, he was called back to Graz in Austria, where he had been living, to teach astronomy and to be the provincial mathematician. His duties included teaching classes, but apparently he was a very poor lecturer and he had very few students. The story is told about him that he was struck by his first significantly creative idea in the middle of a lecture. He stopped talking and was busy thinking and never noticed that everybody in the room, a few people, got up and left. In the key to his discovery lay in his appreciation of the ideas of beauty, of symmetry, and the lure of mathematical elegance. And these traits of a search for elegance, if you will, for aesthetics, really has, and most people, I don't think, outside the scientific world don't know this, but this is a lasting influence on scientists since that time. I have heard many, especially a theoretician, claim that these ideas are just not elegant enough. And such has lasted a long time. In one of Mestlin's classes at Tübingen, Kepler had been introduced to the ideas of Copernicus. And even though, and in the harmonies in the layouts of the planets and the motions of the moon and the sun. Excuse me. Meslin is remembered as a sort of a timid Copernican, but Kepler was a real devotee of the ideas of Copernicus. For him, the harmonies expressed by Copernicus's ideas were a revelation of the glory of God's work. He started his ideas with three basic questions. These were: why are the planets spaced the way they are? Why do they move with such regularity through the sky? And why are there just six planets? That question, that last question in itself, six planets, we count them: Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. But that's a Copernican view, because for a geocentric person, they were Moon, Mercury, Venus, Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. That is seven planets, not six. So that his idea that there were six planets means he clearly believed very strongly in the Copernican system. In drawing the orbits in a relatively correct spacing for his students, Kepler was struck by the possibility that these six planets could be spaced, and the space is determined by the five Platonic solids, which I've shown previously. There are the five solids that Plato said are the only, and geometry says, are the only solids that can be made from two-dimensional plane figures put together. And by carefully placing each of the solids within the orbits, he came very close to fitting the actual distances between the planets. And he published this idea in a book as a very young man called the Mysterium Cosmographicum, or the Cosmic Mysteries. This is quite incorrect. Sorry. These are very incorrect ideas, but the historian Owen Gingerich has written, never before in history has a book so wrong been so seminal in directing the future course of science. What he did was place, but there's the drawing of his model that he included. You can sort of see what he's got. You can certainly see the cube, and there you can see the tetrahedron. And you can even see, I think, the dodecahedron in there. But what he did was place between Mercury and Venus an octahedron, between Venus and the Earth an icosahedron, between Earth and Mars a dodecahedron, between Mars and Jupiter this tetrahedron, and between Jupiter and Saturn a cube. Kepler was a hugely emotional person. And he did not hide his feelings, and he wrote everything that he felt. And this is reflected, as we shall see, again and again. And here's what he wrote about this discovery: how intense was my pleasure from this discovery can never be expressed in words. I no longer regretted the time wasted. I was consumed by the computing to see whether this idea would agree with the Copernican orbits, or if my joy would be carried away by the wind. Within a few days, everything worked, and I watched as one body after another fit precisely into its place among the planets. This is rubbish, but it's true. It's what he felt. Now, Kepler wanted to send a copy of this book to Tycho Brahe. And so what he did is he sent a book to Prague to Ursus, the Reimers, the imperial mathematician, and he also and asked Reimers for his opinion of the book, but he included a second copy in there to be forwarded to Tycho Brahe, because he didn't know his address directly at that time. And obviously, in doing so, he had no idea of the relationship, the hatred between those two gentlemen. He again waxes lyrically to Ursus, and whom he's never met, of course. And here's what he wrote: You were made known to me long ago by your most illustrious glory, in which you alone outstripped the astronomers of this age as much as Phoebus's orb outshines the tiny stars. Phoebus, of course, being the sun. Of this one thing be sure, that I think as much of you as do all scholars. To despise their judgment is a mark of impertinence. To join their praise befits a modest youth. I thought it right to consult you in a matter that is difficult and, in my opinion, not trivial. If you approve of what I say, I shall consider myself fortunate. To be corrected by you, I regard as the highest stage of happiness. So much do I value your judgment. That's a hell of a letter to write to someone. To this letter from an unknown person far away, Ursus made no reply whatsoever. But 2 years later, there was the Frankfurt Book Fair. The Frankfurt Book Fair still exists, of course, and it existed even back in the 16th century. And at the book fair, Kepler's book had been published and was there for sale and was attracting attention. And this caused Reimers to respond to Kepler, which he did in 1597, calling Kepler his most esteemed friend. What he didn't tell Kepler is that he had put the letter in that terrible book on astronomical hypotheses, and he didn't send Kepler a copy of the book, and made no mention of the fact that he had put it in there. Now, having had no response from Brahe and finding out how to get in touch with him, in December of 97, Kepler wrote directly to Brahe with a copy of the book asking for comments. Brahe replied politely and criticized Kepler's adherence to Copernican ideas, which of course differed from his. In particular, he specified three criticisms. First, for Copernicus, the universe was almost infinite, and that was clearly nonsense. Secondly, he made the Earth move, also nonsense, because the Earth is the heaviest of the four elements and therefore cannot move. And third, these ideas are in conflict with Scripture. But the letter was rather kind and had been written from Germany, not from Denmark, because by that time Brahe had already left Denmark. But because the post was, as you can imagine, quite random in those times, it didn't arrive until April of 1598, which was 4 months later. So it's about as often as I get emails from some of my colleagues. Brahe added, I do not know by what chance it happened that the same courier who brought me your letter also delivered to me from the same place a defamatory and criminal publication tied together with your letter, written by a certain wild Ursus rather than a real man. He goes through the entire story of the theft of this hypothesis and criticizes Kepler for praising this criminal. And then he goes on to say, his misuse is such that he wants your letter to purge him, as it were, and to prove how great he is and how highly he is to be regarded. And then he wrote, but you wrote these things through ignorance when you were young, etc. That is why I am rather calm in this affair. And for Brahe to be calm about anything is really quite remarkable. Now, what we have seen, of course, is Kepler had come to Prague, had spent a few months with Brahe. They had argued, but they had agreed about a lot of things. Brahe had made an offer to Kepler that was significant, economically significant to the young man, but Kepler was very skeptical, and wisely so, because even though when you worked for the emperor, you had in principle a considerable salary, in practice it was very hard, about as hard as getting blood from a stone, to actually get your money. So he had gone back to Graz, and then, as I mentioned yesterday, all the Protestants in Graz were forced to leave, and so he did accept and came back to work with Brahe. And his first task that Brahe gave him was writing a book called In a Defense of Tycho Against Ursus, a book he never finished. Kepler wrote an enormous amount, some published, some unfinished, etc. And with so much of his work, which was, as people have written, buffeted hither and thither by the shifting fortunes of the 30 Years' War, eventually Johannes Hevelius bought this manuscript from the heirs of Kepler's sons, and he compiled a catalog. I mean, Kepler was by that time a very famous man. He compiled a catalog of all of Kepler's writings, and he published it in the Philosophical Transactions, which is the journal of the Royal Society in London. A century later, the Tsarina Catherine the Great, at the recommendation of the much greater Leonhard Euler, her mathematician, purchased all of the works of Kepler, and they are still to this day in a library in St. Petersburg. Brahe was primarily interested in the stars, and throughout his lifetime he inscribed on his globe close to 1,000 stars. That was his goal, was to get 1,000 stars. He had less of an interest in the planets, but he did measure them because they were there and they were of astrological interest. And of course, being an incredible observer, he measured them with great accuracy. His idea was to publish new tables to replace the Alphonsine and the Prutenic tables, which were pretty out of date. These tables give you calculational tools to predict where the stars and planets will be every day of the year. It doesn't print the tables themselves. Such tables are called ephemerides, but it tells you how to do it, and it does some sample calculations. When Kepler joined Brahe, Mars had just been in opposition to the Earth. That means the Earth, Sun, and Mars were in a straight line with the Earth in between. Somewhere or other, I have a slide of that, which I can show you in just a minute. And its position was measured to an accuracy of about 2 minutes of arc. Okay. That's a remarkable, remarkable thing. Remember that there are 60 such minutes in 1 degree, and a degree is very small. It's 1/360th of a circle. Now, that may seem a tremendously small number, but if you think about how far away the planets and the stars are, certainly the planets are very far away, such a tiny angle over millions and millions of kilometers means that the distance errors were hundreds of thousands, if not millions of kilometers in space. And no one had ever made such precise measurements before. Now, Brahe gave the problem of calculating the orbit of Mars to his favorite student, Longomontanus, this Danish fellow, Christians, Sørensen Longbæk. But Longomontanus was offered the job of professor at the University of Copenhagen, and he wanted to leave and left. And so the problem of calculating the orbit of Mars was given to Johannes Kepler. And this is a particularly fortuitous occurrence, because what we shall see, and many of you already know, is that the motions of the planets are not circles, they're ellipses. But of all the 5 planets that we can see in the sky, 2 of them, Mercury and Venus, have seriously elliptical orbits. Mercury more so even than Venus. But Mercury is a very difficult planet to observe. It's only up in the sky a short time, either just before or just after sunrise. It's always low in the heavens, which means the light coming from it is difficult to measure because it gets deflected or refracted by the atmosphere of the Earth. As does the sun when it sets. And many of you will know that when you see the sun just touching the horizon, it has in fact completely set in reality, and the light from the sun below the horizon is bent through the atmosphere and appears to our eye as if it's still above the atmosphere, above the edge of the horizon. Mars, however, is therefore the best chance we have to determine the actual orbits of the planets. When I listen to the words that Kepler writes about what he's doing, I find it ever more improbable to believe him capable of anything as heinous as murdering Brahe. Kepler regarded the fact that Brahe gave him the problems of Mars as the workings of Providence. The workings of Providence may certainly be obscure, and to a skeptic like me, or even more so. But for a believer like Kepler, they were glaringly obvious. In his great book, Astronomia Nova, New Astronomy, which he published in 1609, he writes, and I'll quote just a little bit of it, I think, did I not? Yeah, I know I wrote this down here. I regard it as yet another sign of the divine providence that I came to Benatki precisely at the time when Longomontanus was engaged on Mars. For to be able to arrive at an understanding of the arcana of astronomy, it was absolutely necessary to take the motion of Mars as the basis. Otherwise, these secrets would have remained hidden from us. Gingrich has again written, Providence, fate, or accident. It was a long series of circumstances that led Kepler to Mars. If Meslin hadn't been at Tübingen, if Brahe hadn't fallen out with a new king, if Kepler hadn't been forced out of Graz, if Longomontanus hadn't been working on Mars and then given the offer of a professorship back in Copenhagen, etc., etc. Now, here is, again, the geocentric picture. Now, here's Mercury and Venus, and they have exactly the same period as the Sun. Something which Ptolemy cannot possibly predict. The epicycle of Mars is larger than the epicycle of Jupiter, which is larger in turn than the epicycle of Saturn. None of these things can be explained by Ptolemy. And of course, he never tried, because this was not the problem he was interested in. But there is this continual growth of interest in developing a physical system of how the universe really works. And Copernicus can account not only for all of these facts, but can also account for the precession of the equinoxes, this 26,000 period we've seen in which the axis of the Earth revolves. Meslin called Kepler's attention not only to the works of Copernicus, but also to some of his words while he was working on this problem, as reported by Rheticus. You remember who is from Wednesday was Copernicus's only real student. Some of the observations of the ancients had not been honestly reported, but rather modified to suit their own theories. Two, the star places by which such relative measurements were made could be off by as much as 10 minutes of arc, which is millions and millions, or if not hundreds of millions of kilometers in space. Thirdly, there were no recent measurements such as Ptolemy had available to him, hence the importance of Brahe's new data. The periods of revolution of the planets are not proportional to their distance from the Sun, as we shall see in Kepler's third law. But the fact that that is true meant either of two things, either that the force that causes the planets to rotate, whatever that force may be, and it's not angels flapping their wings behind the planets, that either that was different for every planet, or that the force somehow varied with the distance from the Sun. And that's what Kepler chose. He chose the Sun as the origin of a particular force. What force? Well, he didn't know the name gravity, so that wasn't the force. But shortly before, in 1600, in England, William Gilbert had published a book called On Magnetism, De Magnete, and in which he postulated that the reason that compass needles or iron magnets point to the north is that the Earth itself is a giant magnet, which we know to be true. This led Kepler to believe that the force holding the planets to the Sun was also magnetic, which is, of course, wrong, but it's interesting. And what it signifies is he was clearly looking again for physical evidence. When Kepler went to Benatki, if we look at a stellar sphere, what we knew that worked pretty well was we had a theory, Brahe's theory, which worked fairly well for the longitudes, but not very well for latitudes. And in particular, Brahe's theory referred the motion to the mean position of the sun, not whereas Kepler wanted it to be actually at the center of the sun itself. In other words, a force that emanates from the center of the sun, the force we call gravity today. On his deathbed, as I mentioned yesterday, Tycho begged Kepler to carry on calculations using his system rather than that of Copernicus. And even though Kepler believed deeply in Copernicus' theory, and his word led to the triumph, he very conscientiously carried through every calculation for something like 17 years using Ptolemy's theory, Tycho's theory, and Copernicus' theory. Yet again, I think this mitigates against the idea that he could have been a murderer. He had already made good progress even in the year before Brahe died, and he finished his work on Mars about 4 years after, roughly in 1605. First, he proved that the plane of the orbit of Mars passed through the center of the Sun, which was, although it had a constant tilt relative to the ecliptic axis. And he wrote at the time, Copernicus did not know of his riches. He spent an inordinate amount of time calculating and recalculating, using geometry, using trigonometry, and the brand new discovery, which helped them a lot, of logarithms. The problem which he faced has two real difficulties. First of all, the planets do not move in orbits based on exactly the same center. Secondly, and this was something that Brahe had proved, the planets do not move at the same speeds all the time. That makes moving in a circle very difficult. And these two facts of nature have to be faced whether or not you have an Earth-based system or a Sun-based system. Again, Kepler was just a remarkable man because before him, circularity and sphericity were the basis of everything in cosmic order. And he broke with that idea because he had a devotion to data, to facts, an imagination, a faith in the beauty and the honesty and importance of mathematics. And he broke with the ideas that were 2,000 years old that everybody had believed up until that time. This has been described by various historians as one of the greatest elastic feats of the human mind, one which altered forever our concept of nature. What makes Kepler so interesting and unique among scientists is his astonishing honesty and his innocence. And it's his innocence that prevents his honesty from being incredibly embarrassing. In his writings, he tells us absolutely everything, all of his personal feelings, his childhood humiliations, the indignities of ill health, the defects of his wife, the follies of his own aggressions. I mean, on and on he goes, calling himself stupid or calling his wife difficult or whatever. He was apparently quite myopic, and so he couldn't observe himself, but he, of course he was a brilliant mathematician, and that I think made up very well for his myopia. His books are just really, I find, quite amazing. They're sort of a scientific and personal stream of consciousness centuries before James Joyce. Here's a picture of him at a fairly advanced age. You can see, I mean, he's sort of old. In his In his greatest book, again, Astronomia Nova, he notes that Copernicus had referred the motion of the planets, again, like Brahe, to a mean or average position of the sun. But he changed that and meant that this line, which is called the line of apsides, right, the major axis of the ellipse, he called the line of apsides, which Copernicus had passing through the average position of the sun, he made it pass through the sun itself, okay, through the sun itself, rather than through the average position, a real thing. The next thing that he did, let me define. I've promised to show you this picture before. Here is opposition, the sun, the earth, and this is Jupiter. This is opposition, and this is conjunction, when it's on the opposite side of the sun. And what you can see is, of course, since Mercury and Venus are at orbits inside the Earth, they can never be in opposition, right? Because it can never have the Earth over here. It has to be out here. If the heliocentric system, as I've said, is not more accurate than in its predictions of positions than the geocentric system, it does, however, have advantages. And there are two basic ones. First of all, we can see from this position why Mercury and Venus never get very far from the sun, because they can be here, they can be here, and that's it. They can't be way out here. And we can also see why they never are in opposition to the sun. Kepler made no a priori assumptions whatsoever. And if I go back to this, what he did is he calculated the positions of Mars at the ends of these line of apsides, the major axis of this ellipse. And then he got good agreement. Okay? Then he went at 90 degrees to the minor axis, and he got good agreement there. But he was a very careful man, and so he went also to basically what is 45 degrees to the axis. And there he was off. He could not predict the positions he had for Mars were different from the actual measured positions. How much? They were off by 8 minutes of arc. That's just a little over a tenth of a degree. Now, having taught students for a long time, most students faced with an error in measurement like that would have either ignored it or cheated and said it didn't exist. But Kepler was a desperately honest man, and he wrote that, "Divine benevolence has vouchsafed us Tycho Brahe, a most diligent observer, from whose observations the 8 minutes in this Ptolemaic computation is shown. It is therefore fitting that we, with thankful mind, acknowledge and honor this benefit of God. These 8 minutes alone, 8 minutes alone led the way to the reformation of all of astronomy." And so back to his calculations he went. And it took a long time. He spares us absolutely nothing, including this comment, "If thou art wearied with this tiresome method of computation, have pity on me who had to go through it 70 times at least with an immense expenditure of time, nor will it astound thee that the fifth year has passed since I encountered Mars." 5 years of calculation. Now, it's unlikely he spent all of his time on this, because he had to make a living at the same time, but he spent a lot of time doing these things. Since Kepler is such an important figure, the number of historians of science who think about Kepler and who work on Kepler is not surprisingly quite large. One of the best is this man I mentioned the other day, Owen Gingerich, who has written so much about Copernicus. One of the things he did was to repeat the calculations in the early 1960s using a digital computer. He used an IBM 7094, which I can remember, which would have filled the entire front of this room, and which had less computing power in it than that. Okay. So we've come a long way. So this is an archaic computer. Okay. And so he programmed this thing, and he did the calculation that Kepler did, and it took not 70 trials, but 9 trials, and it took not 5 years, it took 8 seconds. Poor Kepler. But it was this 8 minute of arc error that broke the back of the problem and destroyed forever the idea that circles were of primary importance in astronomy. Pursuing this line of reasoning, Kepler discovered what he called his second law before he discovered his first law. His first law just says that the planets move in elliptical orbits around the sun with the sun at a focus. If you want to draw a circle and you're a kid with just simple things, take a nail, drive it into a piece of wood, take a string, attach the string to one end, to the nail, the other end to a pencil, keep the string taut, draw it around, you make a circle. If you want to make an ellipse, you take 2 nails, tie a string loosely between them, take a pencil and put it somewhere on the string and pull the string taut so that both ends are, and go like that, and you'll make half an ellipse, go to the other side, and you make the other half of the ellipse. This is a lot easier to do, actually, than to describe. The 2 nails are called the foci of the ellipse, and the farther apart they are, the more the figure is removed from circular. The sun sits at one of the foci, and there's nothing here at the other. But this is what Kepler tells us in his first law, discovered second, actually is the orbit of all the planets in our solar system. In this particular slide of an ellipse, the sun is down here. This is the line of apsides, the major axis. There's the minor axis. This distance, CV to the center of the ellipse, this would be, for the distance from here to the planet would be the average distance to the planet, and we will see that that's going to become an important number. Here is the second law, which was discovered, as I said, first. The planet moves at different speeds depending on how close it is to the sun. Here it moves very rapidly, here it moves very slowly. If I take and I measure the position of Mars at a given time, and then I wait, say, a month, and I measure it again, and I draw these 2 lines, and I take that pie slice with the curved edge, and I measure its area, and then I wait until Mars out here, 1 month and a month later, and I measure that area, those 2 areas will be the same. Narrow and fat, short and fat, narrow and thin. These areas, no matter where I take this 1 month interval, will always be exactly the same, and no matter how long the interval is. Equal areas in equal times. This law, which took Kepler so many years to figure out, is called is taught to students today as the law of conservation of angular momentum. It was only when Kepler stopped looking directly at Mars and did the calculation in reverse, he put himself imaginatively on Mars and looked at the motion of the Earth as if he were a Martian observer, that's when he really managed to break the back of this problem and came across this particular law. It's a real stroke of genius, it strikes me. Kepler actually calculated the problem in a very careful manner, almost the most efficient manner he could, and he was a very good mathematician. He made no mistakes. The reason it took him such a long time was an amazing one, and one I'm quite familiar with. He had long sets of numbers that he was dealing with, and when he copied them from one page to another, he made mistakes in copying the numbers. These mistakes have been found, and they've been annotated, and we now know that he spent a large amount of time just from copying errors, not from anything else. It's really quite a shame. Again, he doesn't spare us any detail about the agony he went through in his calculations. He didn't know what the shape was. He knew it could not be a circle from the data and from the fact that it moved at different speeds at different times. What was it? He knew it had to be some ovoid shape. He tried an egg with the sun closer to the pointy end and then with the sun at the other end. He tried a shape that breathed in and out. He tried all sorts of things. All kinds of elliptical errors. In fact, he had the right answer, and his long before he finished, his copying errors kept him from finding that. And even when he discovered the final thing, he called them a sorry substitute for circles, or in his own words, a cart full of dung. Now, in 1609, Galileo turned the Dutch spyglass on the heavens, and he discovered that the moon was not Aristotle's perfect body, but was very irregular and had mountains and craters and all sorts of irregularities on it. That was part of the destruction of Aristotelian ideas of cosmology. But then he looked at Jupiter, and he found four moons of Jupiter. And this was an amazing discovery, because for the first time, after all, in the geocentric model, everything has to orbit the Earth. Suddenly, there were objects that orbited something other than the Earth. This was really a revolutionary thing. Kepler was desperate to get his hands on a spyglass, as he called it, a telescope. But Galileo was very chary with them and only gave them to very rich people or noblemen. But eventually, the Duke of Bavaria was passing through Prague, and he had one, and he let Kepler look at it, and then saw the moons of Jupiter and was really quite thrilled. Many people, especially the well-known philosopher from the University of Padua, Cesare Cremonini, refused even to look through the telescope. These things were not very good, and it's easy to imagine that the so-called moons of Jupiter were an artifact of the device. But my favorite outrageous comment is written by an astronomer named Francesco Sisi, which I want to read for you. He wrote this in a book called Astronomical Facts, Dianoia Astronomica. And he says, just as in the microcosm, there are seven windows in the head, two nostrils, two eyes, two ears, and one mouth. So in the macrocosm, God has placed two beneficent stars, Jupiter and Venus, two maleficent stars, Mars and Saturn, two luminaries, Sun and Moon, and one indifferent star, Mercury. The 7 days of the week follow from this. Finally, since ancient times, the alchemist had made each of the seven metals correspond to one of the planets: gold to the Sun, silver to the Moon, copper to Venus, quicksilver to Mercury, iron to Mars, tin to Jupiter, and lead to Saturn. From these and many other similar phenomena of nature, such as the seven metals, etc., which it were tedious to enumerate, we gather that the number of planets is necessarily seven. Beside, the Jews and other ancient nations, as well as modern Europeans, have adopted the division of the week into 7 days and have named the days from the seven planets, which is true in Romance languages. Now, if we increase the number of planets, this whole system falls to the ground. Moreover, the satellites are invisible to the naked eye and therefore can have no influence on the Earth and therefore would be useless and therefore do not exist. I just love that. Now, Galileo, who knew Sisi quite well, was actually quite forgiving, but the French were not so forgiving because Sisi moved from Italy to France. He got involved with court politics. He was on the wrong side of Louis XIV, and he was quite brutally executed in Paris. Kepler's life took many interesting and difficult turns. And in Kessler's book, The Sleepwalkers, you can find wonderful descriptions of a lot of these things. And I'll skip some of them because the time is rushing by. In 1611, the plague came to Graz, and Emperor Rudolf, Kepler's patron, was forced to abdicate because, as I said originally, he never paid much attention to his duties. He was always interested in superstition and astrology. And his brother Matthias took over as emperor. One of Kepler's children died. His wife became really disconsolate following that, and she soon died. So Kepler decided to leave Prague, and he found a position as mathematician again in the Austrian city of Linz, described in his time as the dullest place to live in the empire. But he had no teaching duties, at least. It was very similar to the position he had held originally in Graz, but he had no teaching duties, so he could just calculate or do whatever he wanted, which was very good for him. He had money from as mathematician from there, but he also still held his position as imperial mathematician. So every once in a while, when they actually paid him, he had two salaries. But he was back in Linz and a widower and an important man, and friends and well-wishers pushed him into a second marriage. Again, he writes all the details of this, and he was introduced to 11 women in turn, and he was asked to choose amongst them. He recorded, of course, in his usual direct way, his observations of these prospective brides. At an age just over 40, he describes himself in the following words. I just love this, too. He said, "I am a philosopher past the peak of virility. At an age when passion is extinct, the body dried and softened by nature." And then he describes the various, as he calls them, widows and virgins that were offered up to him in very direct terms, such as, "Her body was strong, but suspect of ill health because of her stinking breath. There was nothing about her that pleased me." After going through all 11 of these women, he finally settled on number 5, Susanna Reutinger, who was 24 years old. Despite being past the peak of virility, they had 7 children. although, unfortunately, 3 died in infancy. And she must have been a reasonably nice woman, because he never wrote anything nasty about her, as he had about his first wife, Barbara. Now, Kepler, again, was a heretic Protestant, and he had been born in a town called Walderstadt, which is in a province today in southern Germany called Baden-Württemberg, and not far from the city of Stuttgart. His mother, Catherine, was still alive, and she had stayed in southern Germany. And this was a time now, we're talking 1611, 1612, of huge conflicts between Protestants and Catholics. And as a result, there was a great rise in witchcraft trials and the unfortunate murder of a lot of innocent women. In Walderstadt, which had only 200 families in the space of 15 years, they had murdered 38 women. And in the nearby town where his mother now lived, 6 women were killed in just 1 year. And his mother, who must have been a difficult person, was arrested for witchcraft. His sister started a libel suit, and which caused problems for the mother, of course, she appealed to Kepler, who came to Germany. And since he was imperial mathematician still, and an important man, his word carried a lot of weight, and the charges were dropped, but his mother was sent off to Linz with her son. She stayed there for about 9 months, but wanted to come back to Germany. Stake or no stake to being burnt. In 1618, there was a very famous incident, of course, in Prague, known as the Fenestration, when two Catholic officials were thrown out of a window in Prague by Protestant rebels. They landed on a pile of straw and therefore survived, and an intervention they said was the intervention of the Virgin Mary. Nonetheless, this was in a sense the final straw, and it started what we know of as the 30 Years' War, which devastated Europe until the peace of 1648, and whose consequences, particularly in Germany, lasted even up until the 20th century. In 1620, feelings had arisen to such a pitch that all sorts of irrational actions were undertaken, and Kepler's mother was arrested again for witchcraft. She was accused of casting an evil eye on children who then got sick, of poisoning neighbors, and of the outrageous action of riding on cattle. What that has to do with anything, I'm not sure. Kepler came again to defend her and found her in chains in a dungeon at 73 years old, a frail old lady, tough as nails, and being guarded by two burly young men, and their upkeep and salary had to be paid by the prisoner, his mother. The proceedings against her lasted for a full year, and she was taken into the torture chamber, shown the instruments, faced by the executioner, frightened, I'm sure, half to death, and absolutely refused to acknowledge anything whatsoever. So finally, she was released after a full 14 months, as I said, and a lot of money paid by her son. She couldn't go back to her hometown because people would have killed her. And anyway, she died shortly thereafter with Kepler returning to Linz. And he set to work on his final great work of the music of the spheres, De Harmonica Mundi. And in this, he published his third law in 1619. He was deeply influenced by Pythagoreans. And as I mentioned originally, the Pythagoreans believed in the harmony of the spheres. Numbers mattered to them, and ratios, simple ratios of strings, for instance, mattered a lot. So Kepler looked for some relationship between the two-dimensional figures of the geometrical motion of the planets and the time at which they periodically rotated. And he tried all sorts of things. He tried the sizes of the orbits. He tried the volumes of the orbits, and nothing mattered. There were no ratios of interest. How about the distances of the various planets? Nothing, nothing. Relationships between the greatest speed and the smallest speed. And here he found a little, he started to find success. What he did was he measured not the speed itself, but the angular speed, that is, how fast this angle changed. And that angle, that angle, that angle. And what he found is that for Saturn, the ratio of the angular speed here, where it's fast, and the angular speed here, where it's slow, is 5 to 4, and that is the same as a major third in music. For Jupiter, the ratio is a minor third, and for Mars, the ratio is that of a major fifth. This is the music of the spheres, if you will, even though there are no spheres. Here, at last, was a relation between the planets that he saw. And from this came the third law, an unusual relationship, and here it is. Namely, he took the period in years of each planet, and he took the half major axis, and then he takes the period and he squares it, and he takes this number and he cubes it, and those numbers are the same. And so there is a relationship between the square of the period and the cube of the average distance from the sun. And this is Kepler's third law. And he writes one of the most famous things, a Te Deum to my God, about his discovery. And again, this is very Keplerian and has become a very, very famous quote. 18 months ago, he said, the first dawn rose for me. 3 months ago, the bright day. And a few days ago, the full sun of a most wonderful vision. Now, nothing can keep me back. I let myself go in divine rage. I define the mortals with scorn in this an open confession. I have stolen the golden vessels of the Egyptians to make out of them a holy tabernacle for my God, far from the frontiers of Egypt. If you pardon me, I will be delighted. If you are angry with me, I shall bear it. Behold, the die is cast. I am writing a book for my contemporaries, or it does not matter, for posterity. It may be that my book will await its readers for 100 years. Has not God himself waited 6,000 years for someone to contemplate his work with understanding? Boy, nobody writes science journals like that. Notice also that the universe to him is 6,000 years old, which of course is nonsense. It was left to Isaac Newton to show that a law of gravity proportional inversely to the square of the distance from the sun must of necessity lead to elliptical orbits. Moreover, Kepler's third law, which took him 9 years to find, can be derived, or Newton's law can be derived from Kepler's third law by an undergraduate in physics today in 4 steps of algebra. Kepler's final work was a compendium of all his knowledge and calculation, the Rudolphian tables, which he dedicated to his mentor, Tycho Brahe. And the publication of these tables was of enormous importance. And I'm going to run over a few minutes because this is the last day, so I hope you will forgive me. Since these were so important, and since they were named after the Emperor Rudolf, even though he was dead, he thought that the imperial court should pay at least some of the cost of publication. Besides, they owed him a lot of money. So the court had moved from Prague to Vienna, so he went from Linz to Vienna, and he begged for about 4 months, and he was granted some money and some of the cost in paper, because paper was fairly dear. Now, for various complicated reasons, he was given this money not in Vienna, but in 3 separate towns spaced around Germany. So he had to travel to these 3 towns carrying this massive paper around with him. It took him 4 years to publish his tables. And which is astonishing in these days when you can print by pressing a button. It took him a year just to get the funds. Now, Linz did not have a decent printing press, so he had to import a press and a printer to Linz. But before he could get to work, yet again there were religious difficulties in the now raging 30 Years' War, and the Protestants of Linz were ordered to leave the city. But before they could leave, there was a rebellion by Protestants and a siege of Linz, and the town was occupied by Catholic soldiers and besieged by Protestant soldiers around the time. As was not uncommon, Kepler's house were billeted a number of Bavarian Catholic troops whom he had to support. life was really a misery. His house burnt down, his printing press was burnt, the paper was saved, and he vowed to leave Linz as soon as the siege was lifted. There was a report that there was a good printer in Ulm, in Germany, so he traveled there. Ulm is the town where some 250 years later Albert Einstein would be born. He had lots of arguments with his new printer, but 7 months later, the tables were finally done. However, there was yet another curse laid upon him, because since what he was using was Brahe's data, he had to obtain the permission of Brahe's heirs to publish, and they were very loath to do so. So lots of argument, and in the tables is a preface written by one of his nephews who knew nothing whatsoever about astronomy, as one can determine if you read what he wrote. Now, with the Rudolphine tables finally done, Kepler was at a loss. Where was he to go? What was he to do? He was a very famous man by this time. He had invitations to go and teach in Italy, to go and teach in Strasbourg, to go and teach in England, none of which was he interested in doing. So he wandered back to Prague, where the imperial court had returned from Vienna. And there he met the general Albrecht Wallenstein, who Wallenstein was a Protestant, but he was fighting on the Catholic side, but they had more money. And he was a very good general, apparently. He had won lots of battles for the Catholics. But he had no real interest in science, but he was very interested in astrology, and he would make no battle plans without a horoscope. And so he hired Kepler as his personal astrologer. And he had a home in the town called Sagan, which is now in western Poland, sort of halfway between Breslau and Dresden. And Kepler went there and was apparently quite miserable. The Rudolphine tables lasted for years and years, but what people wanted to do with the tables was calculate a book of ephemerides, that is a day-by-day listing of where the planets would be in the sky. And lots of people wanted to do that, and Kepler also wanted to do that, of course, because it would make some money. And he did, and he published an ephemerides for the year 1629 to 36. Strangely enough, while in Sagan, he also published his one and only work of fiction, a book called the Somnium, Dream, about a hypothetical trip to the moon. And this is regarded as the very first science fiction work ever done. Now, in Sagan, the 30 Years' War was raging, of course, and this is what Kepler wrote. The storm rages and the state is threatened by shipwreck. We can do nothing more noble than to lower the anchor of our peaceful studies into the ground of eternity. That's just lovely. Now, he was unhappy with Wallenstein and with Sagan, so he left in October of 1630, and he wandered about in the rain and cold of Germany in October and November. And in early November, he came to Regensburg. There he came down with a fever, and within 2 weeks was dead. He was buried just outside the town in the big cemetery, but because of the approaching Protestant armies and a battle, the cemetery was dug up to provide fortifications for the town. Kepler's bones were scattered. There's no grave to visit, no gravestone. But nonetheless, he did write his own epitaph. I measured the skies, now the shadows I measured. Skybound was the mind, earthbound the body rests. Just an amazing man. From Thales of Miletus to Johannes Kepler of Graz, Prague, and Linz, philosophers had searched for the true planetary system. Kepler finished the search. Isaac Newton was to prove that the system found by him not only agreed with observation, but that no other possible physical system could exist. and that's sort of where I should end. We have Galileo and Newton, but not today. Thank you very much.